From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last week in Rochester when a neighborhood was rattled by the sound of gunshots at 2 o'clock in the morning. And maybe you saw a story on the 11 o'clock news, shots fired in Rochester. Unfortunately, you probably didn't hear much more context than that. And that's often what happened in the news. Well, the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT is trying to change that. Researchers have been looking at gun violence in Rochester over the past 4 years, and their working paper offers a fresh look at what's happening, who's more likely to be victimized, and where. And the team behind the paper also offers some ideas on what kinds of responses to this data are appropriate in our community. They've also been researching how neighbors in one particular part of Rochester feel about safety in their own homes and when they interact with police officers. And they've been looking at opioids in various ways, and we saw some data on opioids this week that surprised a lot of leaders in a good way. I mean, no one is declaring any sort of victory on opioids, and tomorrow we're going to talk to the Monroe County Health Commissioner, Dr. Mike Mendoza, and others about that. But some of what's going on at RIT takes a look at what's happening in our community there. So a lot to talk about with the research that often provides the context that we sometimes don't in the news. So hello to Irshad Altimer. Irshad is the director of the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT. Welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Hi, Evan.
And also with us is Janelle Duda-Banwar, who is a senior research associate at the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT. Janelle, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why don't we start with this here? You've got three working papers, and I'm really looking forward to kind of picking up some of the context and what we're going to do with not only taking the data, but hopefully putting it into practice. Irshad, what did you decide to research and why? How did you decide to pursue these ideas?
Well, at the Center for Public Safety Initiatives, we focus on a wide range of issues, but we're really interested in violence, violence reduction strategies, and near-term violence. We're also interested in community relations. And I think just because of the pure impact of the opioid epidemic, we've been taking a look at that and trying to understand how it's affecting our community and things we can do to reduce the likelihood that, you know, people overdose and reduce the impact that it's having on our neighborhoods.
We're going to talk about gun violence, then we'll talk about the Jones Park neighborhood, essentially a survey and what you learned from people who were willing to talk to you. And we're going to talk about opioids. So let's do it in that order. And I'll ask both of you to describe how you approached trying to understand what's going on with gun violence. 2015 through 2018, is that right, Janelle? That's the data, 4 years?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So kind of take, or maybe five, 2000, I'm bad at math. That's why you're here. take us through, if you could, you know, maybe some of the broad outlines of what you're looking at, and then we'll kind of talk specifically about what you found when it comes to gun violence.
Sure. So every year, the Center for Public Safety Initiatives puts out a homicide working paper. So we find it really important for the community to have this information in order to make informed decisions around what policies to support and not to support. And so, as Irshad mentioned, we've been working with law enforcement for 2 decades now. And so they're, of course, interested in gun violence. That's arguably the most serious violence that's impacting neighborhoods. And so what we did was we wanted to look at these trends over time over the last few years to see, are shootings increasing, decreasing? Who are the victims of shootings? What's happening with shootings? Are there certain neighborhoods where the gun violence is occurring? So that's really how that came about.
And Irshad, you know, you and I have had conversations on this program about your own personal background, the research that you do in communities like Rochester, the assumptions, the stereotypes that people have. When you go into this kind of research to try to offer the community, to offer the police department, to offer city leaders information, do you come in, you know, with any expectation of what you're going to find? What do you make of some of the stereotypes that our community may have about where shootings happen or who's vulnerable or who's at risk?
Well, from our perspective, can't really take action without sound data. Mm-hmm. So we're always interested in contextualizing violence, helping people better understand the context in which it occurs. And so for this report, there's not much surprising simply because we've been doing this for several years now. But what our interest is in providing data that will help for a balance understanding of the problem in hopes that we can come together and find effective ways to reduce violence.
All right, 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, City of Rochester shootings, and you have fatal and non-fatal. Now, what I'm looking at here is a pretty straight line on fatal shootings, around 20, just over 20 a year on average, and it will rise a little bit. It dipped a little bit in 2017, but it's been a pretty flat line. Whereas when it comes to non-fatal shootings, nearly 200 in 2015, but roughly a 25% decrease, so down to about 140 or so, if I'm looking at the right line, just less than 140 in 2018. Dr. Altimer, is there a reason for that, as best we can tell?
So, we believe that the adaptation of some evidence-based violence prevention tactics by RPD contributed to the reductions over the last 3 years. So for instance, if you look at that data since 2012, the last 3 years have been at least 15, 16, 17, and 18 were very promising. We saw substantial reductions relative to the previous years. So we believe that the implementation of evidence-based practices contributed to the reduction of the last few years. But we also like to remind people that from year to year, fluctuations in violence are common in urban areas. So, for instance, in Rochester, we can expect about a 20% fluctuation or change in violence over a given year.
In any direction?
In any direction, yeah. If you look over time. That's why the reductions that we saw in 15, 16, and 17 were so substantial, because we were seeing these kind of continual decreases, which were very impressive and encouraging.
Yeah. Before we get into, when you say evidence-based practice, we'll talk about what kind of practice we're talking about. But before we do that, just a note on the math here. We will often see political leaders hail a one-year drop in homicides. And I'm not talking about any specific political leaders right now. I'm not talking about this mayor. I'm just talking about—
It happens everywhere around the country.
All across the country. Yeah. You get a sharp drop in 1 year, and that could be— I mean, I don't mean to be crass about this. We're talking about lives lost or shootings. I mean, those are various serious things, but when you actually look at the data, that can be kind of statistical noise, can't it?
Yeah, and it's absolutely true, and we try to be sensitive to the fact that every one life that is saved matters. But what we want people to understand is that, you know, if you go from 29 homicides to 35 homicides in a given year in Rochester, that's not necessarily indicative of a crisis, because over a 25-year period, that is to be expected. So while we would, of course, be happy to have fewer every year, we think what we don't want to do is assume that a small increase is a crisis, and maybe we change course and you know, people start going crazy and thinking that we have to do a bunch of different things, when that may not mean that.
It's similar to the conversations that have to happen around a poverty initiative, where you go, well, one of the most common questions probably that I had, many reporters, when the anti-poverty initiative started, were, well, what can we expect in a year? Well, you know, maybe not a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to any kind of policy about something that seems so intractable, it can take time. And yet we're looking at a 4-year trend, at least, of a pretty strong decrease in nonviolent or non-fatal shootings in the city of Rochester. So let me ask both of you, when you say practices, evidence-based practices that seem to be working, what are the kinds of things that are happening? What's going on?
So RPD, well, law enforcement, we're working with the Sheriff's Department, Probation and Parole, and the District Attorney's Office on the GIVE initiative, Gun-Involved Violence Elimination, which means that they're focusing on gun-involved violence. And they have to use evidence-based practices. It's a grant through New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services. And so the evidence-based practices are focused deterrence, which really means identifying the highest risk individuals who are likely to engage in violence, and really working with them to get them into services and helping to provide them with what they need so they don't engage in violence. Street outreach is another evidence-based practice that includes Pathways to Peace and Save Our Youth through ABC, going out and trying to engage with individuals outside of law enforcement. And then there's crime prevention through environmental design, excuse me, that's SEPTED. And that's changing the environment to make it not as make it so there's not as many opportunities for crime to occur. And then finally, hotspots policing, which is really targeting certain areas where we know that crime is likely to occur. And law enforcement is using data to make those decisions, which is a shift from how traditional policing had been done historically.
You want to add to that? I thought, you know, when you said law enforcement's using that, Dr. Altimer, do you get the sense now that community leadership in police in the city, they're sort of hungry for this kind of data?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, they're over the last 10 years, whether it's through the Monroe Crime Analysis Center or just the leadership of RPD, there has been an embrace of data and the use of data to drive law enforcement practices. And we think that helps to ensure that the law enforcement is not just responding to calls for service. And you think about in any city, there are hundreds of thousands of calls for service, and we don't want to minimize any of these calls, but that can take the resources of law enforcement. And so the question is, how do you prioritize those resources that law enforcement has to focus on serious violence? And, you know, because at the end of the day, it's serious violence that influences quality of life in the city. It influences community levels of trauma. It influences investment in the city. It influences the willingness of people to come into the city. It influences perceptions about the city. And so it's important that we focus our attention on serious violence.
And so when Janelle cites, you know, essentially four prongs of things that are happening that might reduce the number of shootings that are happening at all, I think people are listening thinking, does that mean there are fewer guns? Has that worked? Do we know if there are actually fewer guns in the city?
It's very difficult to track because we don't do a, you know, most of the illegal guns start out as legal guns. People buy guns legally, and, you know, we don't have a shortage of legal guns in America right now, and they don't store them properly, and they get stolen. And from that point often, they're not traced. And so, you know, if you think about, you know, we have a gun stock of over 300 million guns, the potential for any of those guns to become illegal is high through, you know, theft or illegal sales, what have you. So it's very difficult to know the total number of illegal guns in any city on a given point in time.
And if I could add something on context too. So one thing that through Dr. Altimer's research and Dr. John Klofas' research is that they've really identified in terms of context, the disputes are at the root of a lot of the gun violence. So there's certain individuals who are involved. They know one another. There's sometimes these larger ongoing disputes with smaller, with incidents that might be a shooting or a stabbing or beating somebody up that are happening within the dispute. So there's a number of different players, but when it comes to the gun violence, it's mostly people who know one another, which another thing that law enforcement is doing and some in the community are trying to do is have these dispute meetings. So to really untangle these disputes to prevent the next gun violence incident to occur.
So that's where we were going to go next year. That's a perfect sort of segue into who is victimized most often by gun violence. And I want to be blunt and get something out of the way right away here, because it was right here in this studio that a former assemblyman made some remarks that ended up as national news. Joe Arrigo made remarks saying that he didn't think he could go back to his old neighborhood in Rochester, even in an armored car. And I told him that I lived in Rochester. I'd take him to any neighborhood he wanted to go. And he said, you better have bulletproof windows. I mean, his perception is that there's shootings happening everywhere, that a white man like him who doesn't live in Rochester could just come into the city and get shot. So let's talk about, again, not to minimize any case where someone who is suburban who comes into the city for any reason is shot. But looking at your data, that's not happening very often, is it?
No. The majority of people who get shot in the city are young and Latino males between the ages of 15 and 34. And even though that's the majority, we should keep in mind that those individuals who are being shot make up a small percentage of those total populations. So, for instance, of the active black male population, only a small percentage of that population is going to be exposed to gun violence. That doesn't mean gun violence is not a problem in the city, but I think context matters. And so it is very rare for, you know, the random white person in the suburb, just to be clear, to get shot. I think that what happens a lot of times is that, you know, you turn on the news and, you know, like last week, it wasn't a great week for the city. We had 5 homicides, and people just assume that if they go anywhere in the city, they're going to be victimized. Unfortunately, I mean, the violence is also concentrated. For instance, Northeast Rochester gets around 40% of all the gun violence. And so the violence is concentrated also in certain neighborhoods. And so the violence disproportionately affects poor people in some of our poorest neighborhoods. And even those people who aren't directly victimized in those neighborhoods are traumatized by the kind of the concentration of violence there. I used to live in North Winton Village, and, you know, there was never any gun violence in my part of the city.
Yeah. So before we move on to some other aspects of the research here, just put a fine point on it for people who've had that sort of, I'll call it the Joe Arrigo mindset here. Yes, maybe you've seen a story on the news about a white person from the suburbs went down to the city for a night out and was shot. When that happens, the news may jump on it. And what you will probably end up with is what we might call an availability bias. You know, in your memory, what's available to you to think about gun violence? Oh, well, it was that time that 26-year-old white guy was coming down to the city for a nice dinner, got shot, which is, turns out, pretty exceedingly rare in Rochester. But your mind will go back to the one time a couple years ago where you saw that story. I'm not saying that there's no gun violence. We're looking at roughly 200 cases a year, fatal and non-fatal combined. 5% of shooting victims in Rochester in any given year, around 5% are white. And we just don't see a whole lot of the kinds of things that... So if I could add to this.
So one of the things that concerns us about, you know, kind of the news cycles and how people form their information is that I think that shapes even our collective will to respond to violence, and it skews our information to the extent that it influences what types of crime policy we will and won't support. You know, if you view a whole city as a war zone, then, you know, maybe stop and frisk is not a bad idea. But if you understand that even in some of the poorest and most troubled parts of the city, most disadvantaged parts of the city, there's a small number of people who are active offenders, then maybe you need to have a focused deterrence approach, or maybe you need to have a dispute project that tries to focus on the most violent offenders without alienating the entire neighborhood. So I think for us, we like to reduce these, release these papers so that we can have a more focused community response to what is a real challenge. Violence is a real challenge, even though it doesn't affect the majority of people in the city.
Absolutely. Okay, so when we talk about disputes, you know, Janelle, you brought up disputes being at the core of most fatal and non-fatal gun violence.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
I probably assume that a dispute could be an argument over money, an argument is something domestic. I mean, it's kind of a wide range of what a dispute would be, but it's interpersonal. Is that right?
Yes, it's interpersonal, and the individuals know each other.
Okay.
So it's not random.
Okay.
And a disproportionate number of the people who are in disputes also, we should mention, are oftentimes in either involved criminally in some type of behavior or gang activity. And what this does is it minimizes the likelihood that they'll feel that it's appropriate to use kind of formal dispute resolution mechanisms to solve their problem. And so oftentimes this is when we have these things dealt with on the streets. And so the people who know one another disproportionately, not exclusively, but disproportionately involved in criminal activity are gangs or drug activity. And I mention that because I think that oftentimes because of that, there's some people in our society at least think, well, hey, these guys are just people who deserve what they got, without thinking about the implications of not having a response to violence that is sensitive to this population and responds to the risks and the needs of this population.
One other point before I grab our first phone call, should I be careful not to overreact to the fact that in just roughly the last 4 years, we've seen the percentage of gun violence victims who are women has more than tripled by percentage. Now, it's still a small percentage overall. Mm-hmm. It's gone from about 5% to 18%. Could that be statistical noise, or is that anything to consider?
I don't know if we know yet, quite frankly.
Need more data.
We need more data.
We usually release, like, this report as a starting point to understanding the why. It could be numerous factors, but right now, I don't think that we know. We just thought that it was interesting to let people know that this shift was occurring and we should pay attention to it. And perhaps as a result of paying attention to it, we can better understand why that's happening.
Okay, fair enough. Let me grab our first phone call. It's Jim in Irondequoit. Jim, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi. Boy, I wish this wasn't an 8-hour show. I guess I'm here to defend Mr. Regal, in a sense. It's difficult to sit and listen to people talk about context and in the same breath kind of in a way minimize the what's going on, in the sense that Joe Regal's perception is important, because we should actually be thanking that perception, because maybe it'll draw more attention to how serious the problem is. I live obviously in Irondequoit, and I grew up in the city and travel through the city all the time, and there are certain sections of the city I don't want to go through and go in. And it's not that people are afraid they're going to get shot. It's the fact that it even goes on to begin with, and we all know all the things that are associated with the areas that these occur: the garbage, the drug dealing, the dilapidated housing. Now, you can use euphemisms like the constant, you know, the concentration of poverty, and they're true. We're not really getting to the real problems, and I don't. Joe Regal's comments were essentially taken out of context. He didn't mean, you know, he's afraid he's going to get shot. He didn't mean it in a literal sense. It's the fact that we're just not getting to the roots of the problem. And listening to you say, well, you know, the statistics suggest that things are going down, and then there's a fluctuation, and this is Groundhog Day again. I wish this was an 8-hour show that we can get deeper into things.
Okay, well, stay there, Jim. I mean, I'm glad you called, and I don't know that I can say that Joe Regal honestly thought that he wouldn't get shot. It's just that he didn't want to be around violence. I mean, I think he was very much concerned for his own safety in that program.
Well, he should be. I've been in the same areas he's talking about. I grew up in the city. I'm a pretty tough guy. I'm a hockey player. You know, I'm not essentially afraid of anybody. But I'm telling you right now, during the summer, when I take bike rides, there are places I will purposely avoid because I know better. I don't want my bike stolen. I know that it's happened. No one talks about the smaller crimes that go on. When my first house was in Maplewood, I grew up in Maplewood. You know how many times my garage got broken into? I couldn't stay there anymore. And I don't consider that a bad neighborhood. And I tip my hat to all the people that plant their feet and go, oh, I ain't leaving. I've got friends there that won't leave, and I love them to death. But, you know, let's be honest. You know, who wants to live near violence at all? Let's not minimize it by going, well, you know, you're not going to get shot. It's individual, you know, arguments between personal people. Like, so don't worry, just duck.
No,
Okay, all right, so hold on. Let's let Dr. Altimer respond.
I absolutely don't think that that's what we're saying at the center. I mean, we think that violence is a serious problem in the city. We've dedicated our lives to working on research to reduce violence. We release a paper every year that says Rochester has moderate to high violence levels. We reduce statistics every year that talk about community trauma. We're writing grants to reduce that community trauma. We acknowledge that, for instance, if a kid grows up in Conkey and Clifford in the last 18 years, there have been over 1,000 people shot within 2 miles of his home. I'll say that one more time. If a kid lives in Conkey and Clifford and he's 18 years old, throughout his lifetime, over 1,000 people have been shot since he was born within 2 miles of his home. So we're not here saying that violence is not a serious problem in Rochester. What we're responding to is this vicious day-to-day cycle that causes people to just think that the world is falling, but does not provide any context and does not provide space for us to have intelligent conversations so that we can have strategies and think about how we reduce that violence. And so If we weren't clear about that, if what I was saying was interpreted as everything is okay, no, that's not what I'm saying. My point is that when we think about the violence that comes in the city, we should understand the population that's most affected and have strategies that directly target that population. And we think that by doing that, you'll improve the quality of life in those neighborhoods that you're talking about that face serious challenges.
Does that make sense to you, Jim?
Of course it makes sense. I'm all for it.
Yeah.
When's it going to start working?
Well, listen, I appreciate the phone call, and part of what our guests are trying to do is contextualize data in a way that doesn't oversell a year-to-year, like a one-year change. 4 years has got our attention, but the question is, what are the next 4 years tell us about non-fatal shootings? Will we see, will that level out? Will it go back up to previous levels? Because the question is, what policies are actually working? So let me ask both of you, as researchers now who have your hands on a lot of data, if you're in the room, and sometimes you are, with whether it's RPD or members of city government, what's not being done or what needs to be done more? I mean, I'll start with you, Dr. Altimer. What are some strategies here?
I think one of the things we need to really think about is our community-based responses to violence independent of law enforcement. So, for instance, one thing we note in that paper you've been talking about is that within the last 4 years, 100 people have been shot within a mile of Rochester RGH.
And so, even where a lot of gunshot victims go.
Yeah, a lot of gunshot victims go. And so, oftentimes, there's medicine at RGH, and the people are taken care of, and they leave the hospitals oftentimes in less than 24 hours, and those people are going to survive. And so that's a good thing. The question becomes, what is our community-based response? Do we have a follow-up plan for that person? Are community groups following that person in the community and trying to understand their trauma, the likelihood of being re-victimized, and their likelihood of potentially retaliating? And so we have a project right now in partnership with the hospital, Pathways to Peace, Save Our Youth, United Christian Leadership Ministries, and Rise Up Rochester, and the Rock Against Violence Gun Coalition, that is basically trying to enhance the hospital-based violence intervention to build better capacity of community groups, to respond to the violence. And I think the other thing that we need to think about is that community trauma. I mean, the gentleman who called in, he noted an excellent point, and that is some of our neighborhoods are really severely challenged. And in neighborhoods where there's this concentration of poverty, you do have also concentration of very high rates of violence in those neighborhoods. And so the question is, for the person who just lives there and who's going to work, who's not criminally involved, how does that trauma, how does that violence, how does the proximity of violence affect them and their children? So one of the things that we're trying to do over the next couple of years is encourage discussions about trauma and encourage community groups to be trained in trauma-informed care. And we think that not dealing with the trauma actually contributes to the cycle of violence in the city, because if people are exposed to so much violence, the question becomes, at what point do they decide that, they have to use violence to defend themselves or protect themselves? You know, if you live, for instance, in a neighborhood and you're 18 years old and 1,000 people have been shot since you've been born in your neighborhood, it may make sense for you to think, let me buy this gun from this guy to protect myself, right? And so we think more discussion needs to occur around community trauma, the impact of violence in those areas that where the violence is most concentrated on the community.
Go ahead, Jenny.
Yeah, and related to this is to really build capacity for these neighborhoods, for the residents, for the people who live in these communities, to really activate the power that they have to make change the way that they want change to be. So one of the things we've done, I'm sure everyone's heard, trauma-informed care. That's where there's a shift towards really acknowledging the symptoms of trauma and what they look like. But one of the things with the project that we've done is we've tried to see, well, okay, for the guys who, the victims of gun violence, is there evidence-based, trauma-informed, culturally responsive counseling, therapy available to them in the city. We can't find anywhere that we would be able to send that individual to. So how do we deal with their trauma symptoms in the long term?
And I think, and I mentioned earlier that, again, this is a population that oftentimes is disconnected from our institutions. Maybe they dropped out of school. Maybe they're unemployed. Maybe they have a criminal record. But this population is responsible for, you know, 80-90% of the serious violence. So if we don't deal with this population and their underlying problems, then we won't see the reductions that we want to see.
Let me read an email from Sean who says, "It's just wanted to thank you for doing this show. It is so refreshing to hear a show about gun violence and violence in general that is based on research and facts. I feel like hearing this kind of reasoned dialogue is what we really need to get to the bottom of violence in our city and country in general." That's from Sean. So just to kind of go back to Jim's complaint about some of the comments about former Assemblyman Arrigo, listen, I think what Joe Arrigo said on this program was both cartoonish, misinformed, and you know, I could probably go further, but I'm not saying that that minimizes violence. I mean, Conkey and Clifford is where you said, you know,
yeah.
I mean, there's parts of our city. Think about kids growing up there.
Absolutely.
I'm a father, but even if I weren't a father, it's amazing to think about what kids are dealing with.
I mean, if you think about, you know, the press conference the mayor had and the chief had last Friday near Portland Avenue, and kind of the violence being concentrated there in the last few years, and I mean, the last few weeks, and think about the impact that has on families and perhaps families who can't afford to move. And it's a real serious issue. And I think oftentimes, you know, even if people speak up and the police make an arrest, the trauma remains, and that remaining trauma is really an unspoken conversation. We don't talk enough about the impact of the violence on these communities and on the institutions, on the development of the children. So, you know, thank you for and again, I understand kind of Jim's feelings about this, because it's very, I think some people get offended when we have these like dispassionate discussions about violence. But argument is not that we shouldn't care or not that we shouldn't be upset, but it's that if we do not sit down and have a reasoned conversation, we will not come up with reasoned policy. And if you look around the country, even today, you know, you have crazy policies that emerge just because people are upset, they have to do something. And what that ends up doing is really wasting public resources and distracting the community. And so we just want to, as much as we can, to use evidence to really improve people's lives in the city.
Well, I appreciate that. And Jim, no one is saying that we don't care about violence. I'm trying to contextualize it. I've worked in a lot of different kinds of news in my career, and I'm proud to be here at Public Radio. And I've seen the impact if you don't contextualize news. That's what I'm talking about. And that's what it was aimed at. The stereotypes that, you know, if you live in the suburbs, you can't go to the city. You're not safe. I mean, that's largely not true. I mean, that's just not based in reality. But we should be very much concerned about where the violence is concentrated, why it's there, what happens. One of the things that's interesting to me reading this report and hearing Dr. Altimer and his colleagues talk about what to do for victims, especially for surviving victims of non-fatal shootings, is to realize that if you've been involved in a non-fatal shooting, or if you're growing up in neighborhoods where there that may happen, that, you know, you may be more likely yourself eventually to end up in a situation like that, and or traumatized in different ways. So it's not just saying, well, we can't stop the shootings, let's help the people who've been shot. It's realizing what that sort of cycle means in the future, especially if people can't afford to move and they want, because listen, Jim, people who live in these neighborhoods, by and large, they're not that different from you, man. I know it feels sometimes like it is, but boy, poverty's rough, but they have dignity. You know, they want to raise families. They want to have a peaceful life. I promise. And so I do appreciate the phone call. And now, after our only break of the hour, oh my gosh, it's 12:40. We're supposed to be talking about three working papers. I've got like half the phone lines filled up.
Yeah, and I still got stuff to say.
I know. So I'm going to kind of like shift gears a little bit here and say this. After our only break of the hour, Dr. Altimer's not done. He's got more to say. We'll take more of your phone calls. And then maybe I'll just have to ask them to come back on separate occasions to kind of talk about some. It's just because Jim in the Rondaquite's right. We need 8 hours for this. So we're talking to Dr. Ashad Altimer, who is with us here in studio alongside Janelle Duda-Banwar from the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT, about their research about gun violence in Rochester, the context of it, policy prescriptions, and more. Let's get that break and come back to your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with Amy Stevens and Penny Sterling, two transgender women who met right here on this program, and they're getting ready to launch a podcast of their own called Transformation Thursday. They want to explore how society is affected when transformations happen. And they're going to talk about their own transitions, their experience as transgender women, what they want the community to know. They join us next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You want to add something before we jump back to the calls, Dr. Altimer? I know you said you weren't done on this subject.
No, I wanted to say that, you know, in areas where there are open-air drug markets, or there's social disorder, I do think people feel scared and they feel uncomfortable. And I think one of the challenges for law enforcement is how do you deal with those open-air drug markets without, for instance, violating people's rights or alienating the whole community. And it's an interesting challenge in our city because, for instance, along Clinton or on Jefferson Avenue, there are open-air drug markets, and I think a lot of people would feel uncomfortable in that environment. But in those open-air drug markets, there are also kind of just people moseying around and walking, right? And so if you're on Clinton, you know, you have to be able to distinguish between the people who are selling the drugs and the people who are just walking down the street. Are you going to have a civil rights complaint? And so it's not illegal, by the way, just to stand on the corner, you know. And so it becomes a challenge in kind of those areas where there's this kind of disorder, the perception of disorder, and how you address that issue and address kind of the crime that's associated with the disorder without destroying the trust between the police and the community.
And if I could just add quickly that the open-air drug markets that people might be fearful of, it's not only people who are coming into the city who are fearful, it's the residents as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, to your phone calls we go. And this is Mike in Greece next on the phone. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. I wanted to say first that Rochester and Monroe County is a good place to live. But to Joel Rigo's comment, he's right. If you're in Hudson Avenue, Clifford Avenue D area, driving around, you want to stay on the main streets because you will find on the smaller streets teenagers and young adults standing in the street, and as you drive by, they may make comments or like, get out of here, and you will not feel safe. So that's one thing. So I'm not, you know, I've worked with Rochester Police. They're brave, and they're doing their best to serve and guide and protect. Another thing, Honorable Jack Elliott's mental court and drug court, they're still putting mental challenged people in jail rather than finding them a proper psychiatric living environment. Same with the victims of the opiate crisis. Those victims are being put in jail rather than being treated in some cases, not in all cases. Another example would be Department of Human Services. You show up there at 2:00 in the afternoon on a Friday and say you're homeless and you need to feed your kids. They're going to say something like, come back on Monday. So the people that are with you, you know, I sort of get the feeling they're looking with rose-tinted glasses or whatever the expression is, and need to be made aware that there's a lot of work still to be done to improve the city.
Okay. Mike, thanks for the phone call. Dr. Altheimer, I'll start with you. Janelle?
I can respond.
Yeah, go ahead, Janelle.
Thanks, Mike. So one thing that I want to say is I do agree with you that the law enforcement is going to use the tools that they have accessible to them. Their tools are enforcement and arrest, and then going through the court system and incarceration. So on the front end, particularly, I'm doing some work around the opioid epidemic and the open-air drug market in the El Camino neighborhood in Northeast Rochester. There's what they're running into, the residents are running into, is that we need public health, we need treatment providers out in the streets conducting outreach, so getting out to the community, so before it turns into law enforcement having to arrest someone for a drug addiction. So we're really pushing in this neighborhood to get street outreach on the ground in the neighborhood so that it's on the front end. What we're running into and what we work a lot with law enforcement is that they're more on the back end, so they only have these particular tools at their disposal, and so they're trying to divert individuals into care through court-mandated practices, but whether that's the best approach or not, I think most people would say we'd rather get people the services they need on the front end.
Okay. Dr. Altheimer?
And separate from that, I just want to respond to the rose-colored glasses comment. You know, Janelle spends countless hours in the community walking in those neighborhoods that Mr. Arrigo said, you know, you shouldn't go to. In addition to my work at RIT, I'm actually, I have a charity that I'm the president of called Baraka Muslim Charity on Jefferson Avenue. I'm one of the most challenged part of the city, and I spend a couple of times a week walking through Jefferson and Bartlett area. We spend a lot of time in the city, engaging with the city and the residents, and we're not academics who just sit in the ivory tower and look through our rose-colored lens and sip on our iced coffee. But I think what we want people to understand is that your personal experience or your visceral reaction does not necessarily give the best representation or the best guidance for policy and for prevention. And so when we think about policy and prevention, the question becomes, yes, you're right. Sometimes people who are mentally need mental health issues don't get the help. Well, what do we know about that population? How can we best serve that population? What evidence is there to best serve that population? The point is there's a methodology and approach that we're advocating for the community that we think is necessary to really achieve what I think we all want, and that is a safer city.
Back to your phone calls. As we do that, Jim called back just to say that he thought I mischaracterized him a little bit. And Jim, send me an email and I'll buy you coffee, okay? coffee is on me if you drink iced coffee.
Iced coffee is where it's at, Jim.
That the academics love. But whatever you like, Jim, I'll buy you coffee, and I mean that. It's on me, and I appreciate that. Calvin next in Rochester. Go ahead, Calvin.
Hi, Evan and panel. I'm just calling. I want to make sure that especially to some of the listeners who are calling in from the suburbs who either may have moved from the city or, and I don't want to characterize everyone, but I just want to make sure that people are being real careful about, as we talk about violence and in the city, this was a conversation that I listened to last week when you had the panel with Adrian Hale and Robin, et cetera, that people are calling in from the suburbs who don't have regular contact, or based on what they're saying, they may have lived in the city 20 years ago, or they're passing through the city. What are people who are calling from the suburbs, what are they doing to support the efforts of citizens around violence prevention in the city? There was just a peaceful protest last week with the mayor, Chief Singletary, about violence prevention. I just want people who are listening to like ask themselves, like, when was the last time you interacted with someone, with a student or with a teenager who maybe who lives in the Susan B. neighborhood or lives on the west side of the city or Joseph Avenue? Many people are calling, and it sounds like they're basing their perceptions and their comments just off of what they think they know and not actually interacting with people in the community. I work in the West Main District in a neighborhood that many people characterize as being violent. And that's not to say that there have not been frustrations that I've had as a business owner, but I have never been shot. I've never feared of being shot. I work in a neighborhood where sometimes there are people standing on the corner and it's not always positive activity happening. But my point is just to say, like, instead of just calling in and complaining, actually doing something, going to organizations who are trying to prevent violence, becoming a mentor, because when you actually exist beside Black and brown people who live in our neighborhoods, you will get a very different perception than what you think you know based on the media reports when there are shootings. There may be a shooting. There has been almost every day there's like a shooting, but that can skew what you think if you're not actually having lived experiences with members of the Rochester community.
Calvin, thank you. We appreciate that. Is that fair, Rashad?
I think that's absolutely fair. I also think that one of the things that he mentioned about engaging the community is important. I think, of course, we all are busy. You know, I have 4 children. So when I leave work, I'm very busy. But if we can all think about how we can give time to support community organizations that are trying to respond to these real problems in any way we can, we should. I mean, there are organizations of people from all, you know, different walks of life, you know, Moms Demand Action. If you are interested, for instance, in thinking about how a community organization can help, you can reach out to Willie Lightfoot, Councilman Willie Lightfoot, who has the Rock Against Gun Violence Coalition, because I do think that we're not going to get out of this challenge of crime in our city without greater community engagement and without greater investment in our most struggling cities. And I think that
most struggling neighborhoods.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Yeah.
Most struggling neighborhoods. I think that when you look at some of our most struggling neighborhoods, you know, we have neighborhoods in the city that are below the 10th percentile in poverty level for the whole nation. We have some of the poorest and most disadvantaged neighborhoods in the country right here in our city. And so when we going beyond the law enforcement component, we do have to think about community investment and thinking about community engagement in a way that uplifts those communities and strengthens the organizations that are trying to address the violence problems there.
And speaking of uplifting, so the residents in the El Camino neighborhood, they started to notice a few years ago that there seemed to be more people who were buying drugs. Open air market seemed to be more people selling drugs, more people coming through the city, coming to their neighborhood, buying drugs. And then subsequently overdoses were happening and drug paraphernalia seemed to increase. And so the residents, they did what they could do, what was within their power. They banded together and created neighborhood block clubs to try to get together and share information. And then CPSI, well, Ibero American Action Development Corporation has always been close to that neighborhood and involved in that neighborhood. But then they worked with us to say, okay, you're the researchers, what does the data show? And so what we've been able to do is get data on the opioid overdoses, also looking at also criminal crime that's occurring in the neighborhood, and provide the residents with the tools to advocate for themselves. So really trying to uplift from within to say, yes, you're right. In fact, the data show that in 2017, a third of all the overdoses across the city of Rochester occurred within 1 mile of the Clifford-Clinton intersection. That's powerful to be able to share with the residents, so the residents can go door to door to say, invest resources in this community. And the city is investing resources now.
Ted called in to ask, how do you feel about safe injection sites? Do we have any data on that? I mean, it's not happening here, as far as I know, and it's been sort of legally controversial in a lot of different cities.
Well, federally.
Can't do it.
Can't do it. So the study.
Philadelphia and a number of others, Ithaca, they'd like to do it if possible.
Yes. Internationally, there's been some studies on safe injection sites. And so it depends on what outcomes you're looking at. But if you look at outcomes like HIV transmission, hepatitis C transmission, and even drug paraphernalia in the neighborhood, all of those go in the direction that you want to see them go into, and as well as overdoses. If I'm recollecting correctly, of the safe injection sites that have had research done, not a single one of them have had a fatal overdose occur at the location. That's a win. People get better. People who are struggling with addiction, they get better. They get into recovery. So we want to keep them alive until they transition to recovery.
But we're not yet at the point where we're going to see that, because, I mean, there's a lot of hurdles that would have to happen legally before we would see safe injections.
And culturally. And culturally.
And probably culturally.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. But if we're just looking at the data, dispassionately looking at the data, mm-hmm. the data indicates that the things you would want to start changing in a more positive, productive direction do happen that way.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so Irshad, we got to let you go here. I've got a whole working paper that I even dive into here, and I wanted to talk about tips. So I'm going to ask you this right here on the air. Will you come back? Can we bring maybe some members of Jones Park and those neighborhoods? Maybe next week or some other time we'll come back and we'll talk about what you've learned there, because you've got this whole other working paper.
Absolutely. And okay. We have some other, they do 4 tip sites a summer, and we have another, we're going to do 3 more papers about the other neighborhoods they go to and talk about community engagement and policing within the context of the TIPS project.
All right, I know you're busy and you're hard to get, but I'm going to email you.
Okay.
Okay, because part of what this working paper covered were questions for neighbors on how do you generally feel about the intent and the interactions with police, some things that might turn expectations on their head a little mm-hmm. bit. Also concerns about drug markets, things like that, which I think are really important and tie to what we talked about today, but deserve its own conversation. So Jim and Arondaquette was right. We needed 8 hours. We only had one, but we'll post
7
for you.
7 more shows to go.
There you go. We'll post for you what the Center for Public Safety Initiatives is doing in these working papers, and you ought to see it, because we all can do better at understanding the context. The context matters. The context does not mean violence is not a problem. It means let's find out everything we can know about it, and then do the right things to deal with it. And our guests are helping us with that. Janelle Duda-Banwar from the Center for Public Safety Initiatives at RIT. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And Irshad Altimer, Dr. Altimer, I'll see you soon. I'll send
thanks,
you an email.
Evan.
You got
appreciate it.
More connections coming up.